seeing this as like a generational difference, just, oh, wow, we're changing and growing. The ACNA's becoming more mature and the new people aren't going to get what the old people are upset about. Stop it. Just think about this biblically. Biblically, you cannot be in fellowship with an apostate church.
Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, August 25th, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, Nick.
No time for witty banter today. We have what appears to be, at least to some, a full-blown crisis in ACNA. For those who don't know, Bishop Chip Edgar of the Diocese of South Carolina participated in a consecration and Eucharist service at the dedication of a new chapel on the campus of an independent Christian school for which he serves on the board. Now, Ruth Woodliffe Stanley, who serves as Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of South Carolina, also serves on the board of the school and participated in the service. The two bishops consecrated various pieces of chapel furniture together. Though neither celebrated at the Eucharist, they received it side by side and together participated in distributing it to the congregation. There's even a picture of the two of them standing together, each with a hand on the bishop's crozier, symbolizing, of course, the shepherding and discipline of the church. And we do have a letter from Bishop Edgar. It was copied into the comments on David Roseberry's post about this same topic, explaining some of his thinking, which I'm sure we'll look at in a minute. Some think this is no big deal, but there has been quite an outcry online. Where do you guys come down?
I'm in the fence. I just don't know. I'm having a hard time coming to.
I ain't for it. I'm against it.
No, I mean, I think it's, I don't, I honestly don't see, I've been pretty surprised by the people who have acted as if it's not that big of a deal. I don't think David Roseberry's saying it's no big deal, but I'm surprised by the kind of almost the waving away of the issues and, a sense that those of us who do find it to be a very big deal, and there's a whiff of this in Roseberry's piece. I don't think he meant it this way, but I've heard it elsewhere too. Of, well, you know, they're just not over their trauma yet, and so this hit really hard because of the traumatic things they've gone through, and you know, we just need to let time go by, and then it won't be so traumatic for them when these things happen. And I this isn't about past trauma. I'm fine. I think you're fine. We're all fine. We're happy. I don't think about the Episcopal Church ever. No, what this is about is because what happens at communion, that because communion is a mystical partaking in the body and blood of Christ, through which, because we partake of one loaf or one body, Bishop Edgar has communicated that we are one body with the Episcopal Church in its worst manifestations of itself. Because Bishop Ruth, despite the fact that she sounds like a very nice lady,
they're
all very nice. But she is full on the front lines of the radical position. Both in terms of sexuality and abortion in the Episcopal Church. So this communion service indicated that she's a legitimate Christian minister of the gospel. And if that's true, we are in schism. If it's true that the Episcopal Church is a Christian church and can be, and the ministers of the Christian church who take the most unorthodox positions are truly sisters in Christ, brothers in Christ. We should not have left that church. We are now in sin. We need to repent of our schism and join the Episcopal Church. On the other hand, if in fact she is what she is, a devotee of a different religion. I mean, she worships a Jesus who's fine with baby murder and homosexual sex and transing various individuals making changing their bodies, they mutilating their bodies so they appear male when they're female or vice versa. The because she is a devotee of a different Christ, right? That was actually a syncretic service. So we're just the merging of a pagan religion with a Christian one, and it was blasphemous. So I don't I what are we going to do? We can't let it stand without it being communicated that we are right now in schism, right? And the original decision to choose to leave was schismatic. And that's one option. The other option is to have either him come out and apologize, confess that that was a wrong thing to do, or the bishops need to take some kind of action, I think.
Yeah, I'm caught. I mean, I have a lot of different emotions. I mean, one, I've just left that diocese, and Bishop Chip has been, I've known him many years, and he was a good bishop, despite perhaps some differences. At the same time, I also served two churches, both of whom lost the lawsuit. One, St. Luke's, was reversed after some months. But Christchurch Mount Pleasant, is right in the middle of rebuilding a building, half a mile from Christchurch Episcopal. And, as we've said for many years, there's nothing more clarifying than moving out of a historic building and having to worship in a school gymnasium, that still smells like those bag milks or whatever they have in there, and yet, there's something beautifully clarifying and galvanizing about that. And so, I'm torn because I'm deeply sympathetic to the kind of impulse to want to show magnanimity where you can. But to your point, Matt, I think that I guess my general sense is just both the sense of disappointment, but also missed opportunity. And it goes beyond just simply this particular service. Like this, evidently, there's this kind of brackish Episcopal ACNA school down in Charleston, which I was aware of. I mean, while we were there, and as our listener may know, I mean, Liza went up through these Episcopal boarding schools, and then I worked in Focus for many years up and around them, up and down the Northeast, and for decades at least, not longer, which has necessitated something like Focus. There was an obvious recognition that if you were a genuine Christian, you probably have to hire someone like me to come, help sort of fill in the gaps, you might say. But and so there was kind of a recognition there amongst the families that I worked with that it was a relatively hostile environment that we were compensating for, and there was a kind of a and this of course was decades ago before the ACNA existed, but to have a school that somehow exhibits this collegiality and this confusion from this service on down. I mean, apparently they have Episcopalian and ACNA chaplains. There are Episcopalians and ACNA people on the board. There are people who worship at the, I assume it's Grace Episcopal in Charleston, and also St. Philip's, and all throughout. There's nothing, you can write what you want to relate as clearly as you can, but as the old adage says, a picture is worth a thousand words. And I couldn't help but just look at that congregation of students and say, whatever else we have been teaching or whatever convictions lie behind the supposed differences between these two churches, like we're observing and witnessing and then participating in something that carries not just theological significance, but sort of physical and visual meaning. And you couldn't help but walk away from that thinking, what's the big deal? I can't remind of the famous Living Church article, why can't we all get along? Apparently we can. Apparently we can. And that seems to be what's communicated. And I don't want to impugn the deep convictions of Bishop Chip and the sacrifices he's made. And I know that he doesn't think we can all get along, at least in most places. But evidently, this this chapel and the service and the school is one of the exceptions.
Three sort of rationales that I've heard. I think I read them in Bishop Edgar's letter, and that I've heard online before we saw his letter, was that one, this is not a church. Two, neither of them celebrated the Eucharist. And three, they are friends of long standing. So, do any of those three qualifications mean anything to you guys?
I mean, no. The last one is totally irrelevant. I don't. I. Who cares? I mean, I'm glad you're friends. I mean, that's great. But Second John doesn't say, don't even greet one someone who brings a different teaching, unless of course you're good friends. Then go ahead and greet them as Christians, right? And Paul doesn't say in 1 Corinthians 5. I'm telling you not to associate with those in the church who claim to be in the
Or
church,
the name of brother, that's the important part, right? Yeah.
right? Who claim to be in the church and claim the name of brother or sister with such a one, do not even eat. And there's no exception clauses for that. There's no, well, what if we serve on the same board in the school? What if we're good friends? What if we're blood relatives? It doesn't
Well, yeah,
matter.
Jesus doesn't even allow the division between, mother and a daughter-in-law, or brother against
Right.
brother. I mean, this is the division is an unfortunate yet necessary witness to impaired communion. I mean, that's
Yeah.
what we have been commanded to observe.
So that Dave Rosier's piece went a long way to describe their background, their friendship, and how they work together to alleviate some of the painful consequences of the litigation there in South Carolina, and I'm glad for that. I'm glad churches were able to not lose their buildings, and their people were able to come to negotiated conclusions about these things. That doesn't negate a bishop's obligation to obey the scriptures, and we've as we said, I mean, I think we say it like at least once a month on this show. What happens when you treat a wolf as if the wolf is a shepherd is that lambs get devoured, because the sheep looking on don't understand what don't will not that congregation was full of kids,
That's right.
and they are now going to see Bishop Ruth Whitliff Stanley, is it, as a legitimate Christian minister, when in fact, if they listen to her teachings and follow them, they will be damned. That's how serious this issue is, because she's preaching a Jesus who doesn't exist, and who and she's promoting practices which Jesus explicitly through his apostles says will damn you. So I just don't I see no excuse at all for ever doing this. Second thing about communion, I think Canon Weber wrote an article on this, which I thought was very good. The reality is they did share the same loaf. They t shared the same the same sacramental partaking of the body and blood of Christ. It doesn't matter who consecrated it.
Right. When the ACNA primates refused to take communion at Lambeth, it's not about who's celebrating, it's about who they're kneeling down next to.
Right,
That's
exactly.
right.
Because communion is about we are made one body by that
Right.
test. So the liturgical, the ins and outs of who did what are also irrelevant. It's the fact is there was a Eucharistic service and they both took part. What was the first one you said?
That it didn't happen in a church.
I don't care. I mean, again, there were no church buildings when John wrote Second John, and there were no church buildings when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. There were people, churches were meeting in houses, right? So I don't know. It doesn't matter if it's a church building or not. The point is the assembled body,
That's
the
right.
gathered, right? So the church, the word church is ecclesia, which means assembly. So there were people assembling in the name of Christ for a Eucharistic service. So whatever the building was, it was at that moment, that was at least that was being purported to be a church. There was an assembly of Christians meeting together to worship Christ and to hear his word and to receive his sacrament. So the setting is also utterly irrelevant. It could be in a warehouse. It doesn't matter. So on all counts, there's just no excuse for this. And I think what I don't understand is how very intelligent people I respect can't see how this endangers people's souls. I don't, they, they're, I think you a minute ago, I think JD, you were talking about how, or maybe it was somewhere else. Maybe I'm getting confused here. But how the social interactions between elites in South Carolina or anywhere really, it doesn't have to be South Carolina, how, you think, well, we have to be a polite and civil, and we don't want to be rude to anybody, and I mean, you can't cause a thing. And I understand that pressure. I do. And in general terms, it's fine to not ne necessarily go out of your way to break any social taboos of politeness. I get that. But this is again about souls and about fidelity to the word of God. So when it comes to those two things, politeness goes out the window. Who cares? Politeness be damned at that
And
point, because you
you can de decline politely.
yeah, I'm not
You
saying being
can
mean,
very politely say, I cannot partake in this service.
right? But I mean, I think they might say like social norms would require us to be here, but I'm saying, yeah, but of course, politely decline, but don't let the social norms dictate your behavior.
I mean, I was uninvited from, I was asked to give the benediction at a graduation at a private school at one point, and I knew what the assignment was, to quote Ketanji Brown Jackson, and that I wasn't going to be able to pray in the name of Jesus, or an explicitly Christian prayer. I could do, like, I don't know, I guess I could have said God. And I called the headmaster and just politely had a conversation with him and said, I just want you to know that I'm, as an ordained minister, it would be quite confusing for my students at this school if I didn't offer an explicitly Christian prayer. And so, if that's okay. And then he said, sort of hemmed and hawed a little bit and said, well, we have people of different faiths. And I said, well, I understand that. That's why I wanted to give you the option of, declining the invitation, which he did. And I assumed incorrectly and naively that that was a polite way to do it. And then, of course, that came back to that was referenced in a variety of oblique and passive aggressive ways shortly thereafter. Nevertheless, I felt like, well, to this point too, it's like I had students, represented in families, and I was at that point leading them and making some, I thought rather straightforward, but nevertheless also contentious statements about, about Christian, the truthfulness, the veracity of Christianity, and the need for people to be saved, and all the things, and it would have been unnecessarily confusing, and ultimately, I think, discouraging, if not disheartening, for those people. And again, I'm not saying, again, I'm trying to be, I'm caught in this emotionally, because I've, we're talking about, like you said, Matt, people that we, I may have disagreements with, but largely respect and want nothing but the best from, and the opportunity, well before this event, to politely but with great conviction say, no, in fact, we're not going to participate in this confusing, sort of brackish, syncretistic endeavor. As much as people want to pretend in certain circles of old Episcopalian world, in which we've lived in many of these different places and have interacted with them, sort of pretend that we can all get along, maybe we don't actually disagree, like we're really kind of just divided at the time. And we've talked about this before. I mean, there's a whole segment of people sort of represented by that redeemed Zoomer guy online who essentially are waiting for the hotheads and the ACNA to die out, or in whatever conservative denomination, and kind of get grafted back into the to the pensions, the property, and the prestige. But if you've had that, I use this analogy all the time, or this example, if it's like Edmund and the Don Treader, or Eustace, excuse me, if that's been ripped off of you or squeezed out of you or has been killed, then not only is there no going back, but there's a real affront to the sort of presumption that perhaps the divide is not as great as the sacrifice had been,
That it was
and
all
so
really an overreaction, wasn't it?
yeah, for sure. Like, we could I couldn't help, because I was in South Carolina, before. I mean, Bishop Lawrence was my bishop for many years before Bishop Chipp came. And to his credit, he took a contentious diocese that had the possibility of losing everything, and didn't lose everything, lost some, and there's been some reordering and all the things. And so there's a lot to be grateful for his leadership and his direction. But I couldn't help but be reminded, and I think David Rosemary linked to it, the kind of notorious or infamous article in the Post and Courier that came out right when the lawsuit was sort of settled, when and it had this sort of puff piece with Bishop Chipp and Bishop Ruth, pictures, and this kind of almost aspirational sort of seeming from the Post and Courier, which is the Charleston paper, about the new day, like this rancor's behind us, this the hatchet's going to be buried. And of course, hanging over all of that article was people that had been thrown out of their buildings, who were Camp St. Christopher was about to go, people who had spent of their own tithes and offerings, millions of dollars in lawsuits and all. And the reaction to that, among some, was like, well, wait a minute. Like, I understand we don't want to like take up arms here, but like, there was a significant and persistent disagreement. And I couldn't help, I this statement from Bishop Ruth in that article, quote, "We have a hope together that transition can occur in a way that reflects the highest ideals in the gospel of Jesus Christ," Woodruff Stanley said. And you're sitting there saying, what, it's like worm tongue. I mean, this is my experience with the Episcopalian leadership from my first introduction to them, is that, that the words sound good for the most part. It sounds Christian, and it sounds reasonable and even gracious. But pull back the cover, and to your point, Matt, you have I mean, ostensibly the most godless, anti-biblical, heretical entity that's ever claimed to be a church, on the, I mean, maybe you could throw the Metropolitan Church above that, but I mean, but with few exceptions, you had Bishop Spong in your pedigree. And again, I don't say that like you, Matt, with a sort of burning resentment and sort of watching, I have all my Twitter feeds linked to various Episcopal, spokespeople or whatever. I could care less. But for the fact that I look at both those kids at that school, and then by extension, the community down there in Charleston, and say, well, there's an opportunity here to make a stand and to clarify and to politely, as politely as possible, say, no, we cannot get along. And yet we're in this situation we're in. And it's just discouraging,
That's
frankly.
the irony, is that the ACNA said we cannot get along in the most public and formal way possible by withdrawing itself, drawing up a new constitution and canons. We were all there. I mean, despite claims made in the august pages of the Washington Post, this was not an off-the-cuff overnight decision. This was decades of wrangling with the question, can we stay in communion with this church? And it was finally the decision that no, we cannot do this anymore. And the this in that sentence, we cannot do this anymore, is exactly what happened at that school. That's what we couldn't do anymore. And it hasn't even been 20 years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Dave Rosemary mentions in his piece that we're getting a lot of newer people in the ACNA now who just haven't been through all the wars, right? So they don't understand the rub, and they are reaching out to their Episcopalian neighbors and making common cause where they can. And when they hear us talk, I mean, it sounds like just a bunch of old men grumbling on the porch, right? They get off of camera. But again, but I understand that that's what it sounds like. But I don't, and I'm not, this is where it does not matter whether I lost my building or I kept my building or you lost your building or you left your building or what the Episcopal Church did to us 24, whatever long ago, it does not matter. What matters is what the scriptures say about what has happened and what the scriptures say about the present condition of the Episcopal Church. That as an official body, they have adopted doctrines that lead people to hell. That's a pot. You cannot become you're that's that makes the Episcopal Church apostate. Now that doesn't mean there aren't Christians in the Episcopal Church or that there aren't faithful ministers still there working as hard as they can, but the body as a whole is apostate. And so whether you went through the wars or not, even if you're 24 and you're just kind of prancing onto the Anglican scene, you've got to say, okay, well, what does this mean with regard to the scriptures? How am I as a Christian, minister or not, how am I as a Christian supposed to relate to people who claim to be Christians, but who promote things that Jesus abhors and hurt people that Jesus loves and preach things that Jesus has said we ought to be abominated? Well, we even have, as I said at the beginning of the show, we have Bible passages that tell us what to do. So seeing this as like a generational difference, just, oh wow, we're changing and growing, the ACN has become a little more mature and the new people aren't going to get what the old people are upset about. Stop it. Just think about this biblically. Think about this biblically. Biblically, you cannot be in fellowship with an apostate church. You can't. So that would include, this is why I don't go. I had a group of Mormons coming by my house for like a whole year, and they were great people. Really like them. Much better people in some regards than I am, many regards than I am, as far as their just conduct and the way they hold themselves and the discipline of their lives. But they serve a different Jesus. So I can't worship with them. I can't do mutual ministry projects in which
That's
it
right.
might be communicated that they're Christians alongside with me and working under the same terms I am. Think about this is exactly what was going on in Corinth when Paul writes the Second Corinthians, and the people he calls the super apostles, who are neither apostles nor super, are presenting themselves as Christian ministers. And Paul said, and they're not. That's in chapter 11. He says they have a different Jesus, a different gospel, and a different spirit. And he says, so I do whatever I can to undermine the ministry of those who claim to work on the same terms I work on. And that's exactly the claim that Bishop Ruth is making. She claims to work in the same terms that Bishop Chip works on, when in fact she has a different Jesus, a different gospel, and different spirit. Paul sought to undermine their ministry. He uses some of the harshest language he uses in his letters in Second Corinthians, speaking about these super apostles. And it's the duty of a minister of the gospel, the true gospel, to undermine the ministries of those people like Bishop Ruth, not hold a crozier with them or yuck it up behind the table with them. That is the exact opposite of what a Christian minister is supposed to do.
We put it in
Well,
the
and I think
ordinal
you.
for the consecration of a bishop that their job is to banish false
Right.
doctrine,
Exactly.
not.
Well, and I think. Sorry, go ahead, Nate.
I'm done.
I think you said it maybe before the show in our long, extensive note taking before we started recording, that the only, and maybe David Virtue referenced this too, like the only sort of winner, if you could put it in those terms, for something like this are the people who want it to be less of a deal, less of a split than it actually is. You know, that whatever else, again, we haven't heard, you know, we have that letter referenced, and you know, like David Roseberry, like I'm trying to reserve, you know, sort of in explicit judgment. That being said, there's public action, we can comment on that. But the only person that really, the only group that comes out of this excited are the people who are kind of think that the whole thing was overblown. You know, and particularly down, I think David Virtue mentioned in South Carolina, like the ACNA won. I mean, we, you know, if you're going to use those terms, I mean, the majority of the churches, the majority of the people, you know, these beautiful historic buildings. I mean, I've served and been in many of them for the past 8 years, and so, you know, there's, as I said before, you know, there's nothing more clarifying about your own convictions than moving out of a historic, beautiful building and into a, you know, like I said before, into a cafeteria. But one wonders, you know, how many people actually would have done that. You know, again, I'm not impugning any, I don't know everyone in the whole diocese. But you know, it's hard from my perspective. You know, moving from that diocese to Living Word, which I loved being here in the diocese and with at Holy Trinity. Nevertheless, you know, it's a much different sort of history. You know, I mean, at our diocese convention, it was, you know, almost everyone is a church plant, or many of them. You know, very few historic buildings, very few sort of legacy generational members. I mean, with some exceptions. And you know, you look at that diocese compared to the Diocese of South Carolina, and you say, well, we're glad that we're together, and we're certainly in the same province, and we're pulling in the same direction. And yet, when the opportunity to sort of distance yourself theologically, and then by extension sociologically, from all of the trappings and all of the allure of the flesh pots of Egypt, as it were, you know, we get this instead. And it's like, you know, I know, again, I'm not saying this is Bishop Chip, but I know that there are people in and around that school that are celebrating the fact that, you know, see, like it's been a little bit of an uncomfortable blip, but we were here for 100, 200 years before, and we're gonna be here 200 years after, and all of this unpleasantness is gonna just go away. And this is not necessarily a first step, but a small indication of the eventual reconciliation. And you know, that's just a tougher pill to swallow when you're at a cafeteria or a, you know, a redecorated Stride, right, like we've talked about, or whatever. And yet with great conviction and great you know, courage. And I think, again, that's just where I just keep coming back to the seeming unnecessary. The whole thing seemed to be so unnecessary, and then by extension demoralizing in a way that it just didn't have to be. You know, there was polite ways to navigate, even insofar as like it didn't have to be a communion service. You know, it could have had like some sort of, you know, dedication and put a bell up or whatever, and let the kind of brackish school continue to confuse its kids. And none of us would have known anything about it. But it, you know, as it were, it was pasted all over the internet and high res beautiful pictures, and that's just a tough thing to swallow. It's a tough thing to see, and it's I think it's rightly receiving some real pushback.
The this you guys remember the Tory Bakham controversy, I think, this broke out in 2011, 2012. For those of you who don't listening, Tory Bakham was the Episcopal, I'm sorry, the Anglican rector of Truro Church in Fairfax, Virginia. And he struck up a friendship with Bishop, I think, Sean Johnson, who is the Episcopal bishop in Virginia,
Wasn't that
Virginia.
Lee? Wasn't that Bishop
Hey,
Lee?
Lee
Oh,
might
you're
have been
right.
retired at that point, but I'm not sure.
No, yeah,
I'm
you're right. It
sure
was
all I
not.
know is I'm sure he was a really nice guy. A really nice guy.
Wasn't Lee. It was his
Yeah.
successor. Yeah.
Lee was
So,
the bishop when I was in Virginia, which was before you guys were.
right. He was there when I was there too.
Okay.
So Johnson took over afterwards. So he struck up this friendship with Bishop Johnson, and they began to do some ministry partnership work. And a lot of people, I found out about it, a lot of people found out about it, and we writing articles and article just They, I don't know, to my knowledge, they didn't do a joint service together. I don't think they did a Eucharistic service together, or even a from what I know, I don't think they did morning prayer together or compline together. What they did though is a kind of a mutual ministry work. That was enough back then. This was 2011. That was enough back then to get his bishop down his throat, saying, "Hey, you can't do that," which he finally did. It took a long time, but he did it. So it's to his credit, his bishop. I think it was him or who, but he jumped in and said, "You can't. This is not. This communicates something that's not true. This communicates that we are in a relationship, an ecumenical relationship with the Episcopal Church. If anything, it would be an interfaith relationship, but we're not there." So, what's striking is that this is, I would say that was a fire, be a one alarm fire. This is a conflagration. This is an inferno compared to that. This is far, far, far worse than the Torrey Bakken situation. And I don't see why. And the response on the part of bishops, I think, should be, okay, this is a real emergency situation. Let's call a meeting at the College of Bishops. We have to do something to draw a line. So that no bishop in the future ever does something this egregious. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I hope something is going on behind the scenes. But if this is just kind of passed over, I'll go back to what I said a minute ago. If this is just passed over, then what has been communicated publicly is that the Episcopal Church is a church, a legitimate church, and the people who have the beliefs that Bishop Ruth has are legitimate believers. And that being the case, our original decision to leave the Episcopal Church was schismatic. And so, I mean, if the bishops want to leave it there, I guess that's okay. Well, no, it's not okay. I guess that's what they're going to do. But it's not okay, and it will have consequences down the road, spiritually, for lots of people.
Well, and doesn't this just point? I mean, again, we talked about this, what, 2 weeks ago, with respect to whatever that church was in Atlanta or Tulsa or somewhere, I forget. Just wondering sort of out loud, like, what are the distinctives that someone, even this hypothetical new convert to Anglicanism is 24, who just came in and is not wizened and hard, battle hardened like the rest of us, crotchety old men are. Why did they come? Like, why did they come? If you were at Portugal, or name your sort of large American city in the South in particular. I mean, I've got churches and people in mind, but I'll just leave them in general. And there's been a concerted effort to downplay, or at least to publicly mitigate the whatever differences we may have had in the old past, fiery and when we were also fiery. Why wouldn't you go to one of the beautiful churches, the quote
Right.
unquote conservative Episcopal churches? Why wouldn't you go to one of these, again, beautiful old buildings, with all of the history and the social connections and the paid choirs and the manicured lawns? And again, nothing wrong with any of that entirely. I mean, I would love to have all that, but what good is the whole world if you forfeit your soul, sort of thing. And yet, what are we communicating? Apparently it's not the whole world. It's just a little bit of a slight momentary inconvenience for those people in the past who were too caught up in their biblicism or whatever they might say. And again, I don't personally feel offended. I just feel, I'm sitting here with a bunch of kind of new converts to Anglicanism. I mean, there's college kids coming through, and many of them kind of trying out different communions and reading theology and trying to figure it out. And it seems like the ACNA is doing its best to make our job much more difficult in any sort of clear and decisive way. Because what I'd like to believe is that we have a beautiful building. It's small, but like if somehow it got taken away, and we ended up again in the cafeteria, or these kids leave here and they end up in some church plant situation next to a big, beautiful, old historic Episcopal church that doesn't explicitly perhaps fly all the flags and do all the things, but under the hood is just the same as all the other ones. And what are we teaching and what are we displaying and what are we witnessing to them is very important to me as a brand, as it were, to ACNA, and that's what this is, find this problematic, because it's far away geographically, but we are relatively small and we're interconnected, and this is one of the flagship, at least from a numerical and property value status, one of the flagship dioceses. And it's problematic. Again, I certainly don't know what's going on, if anything. And like David Rosenberry wrote, I think there are a variety of different ways to see an outcome to this, but I don't think, to your point, Matt, that it should just go sort of ignored. Like some of you people, are a little too uptight and nothing to see here. Like I think we at least could expect a little bit more appreciation of at least the response that is being given, and we look forward to we don't deserve an explanation exactly, but as we walk together, it would sure be helpful to know how we're supposed to digest this and what this in fact means for our kind of public witness over and against the Episcopal Church.
I mean, I think we deserve a, an, I think we deserve an explanation. I think the church, this person's the bishop of the church, and you're not just bishop of one diocese, you're a bishop in the church, of the church. The church deserves an explanation. What were you doing? What were you thinking? And the explanation can't be, well, we're good from you. You just, if you knew all the stuff that happened, if you knew all the background, you wouldn't object. That's, I've heard that from several places today. Well, you just don't have all the facts. You don't know what was really going on behind the scenes. The it, it and I think we've already effectively said it does not matter, because we see what happened. There were pictures taken. So
Well, that's why we need the explanation, because we don't have all the facts. That's the whole point. If there are facts, if there are mitigating factors, we need to know about them, because without them, we see what we see.
I don't think there can there, what I What mitigating factor could there possibly be? It was an open violation of the scriptures with photographs. It's
Show us
like,
from the Bible how this is okay.
yeah, that I mean, so there's no background explanation. Well, we had this a deal going on. No, there's no explanation that will excuse it. It's kind of like an adulterous affair. Okay, I'm sure there are reasons why a husband might cheat on a wife and why a wife might cheat on a husband. You can give me the reasons, and we can talk about it in counseling. But the fact is, it's adultery, and this is adulterous. I mean, in spiritual terms, this is an adulterous thing that's happened, and so it's yeah. I'm sure there are things you can get on. You can when Bishop Edgar finally does explain publicly, I'm sure there are things that he could say that we're going to say, oh, I can sympathize. I can see why you felt like you should do this. I can understand why you felt why you in that situation. I might want to do the same thing. That's fine. You could probably do that again with an adulterous affair. You could say, oh, well, if my husband were ignoring me for 2 years, I understand wanting to hop in bed with somebody else, but it's still an adulterous affair. The reasons behind it don't excuse the actual thing that actually happened. And I hope if the explanation comes, that it will be one of where that is confessed. I did this. It was wrong of me to do this. This was, I take responsibility for it. It won't happen again. Please forgive me. Here are the reasons I did this, but it doesn't, the reasons don't excuse the fact that I did it. And if that were offered, oh, but that would be wonderful. Total forgiveness. Let's just go on then and have a church.
Well, and that's where, again, the sympathy can come in, to how complicated these human relationships are. I think one of the references in one of the letters we wrote or was online or something said, I guess the head of the school is a member of St. Philip's or something, or some, there's some combination of this, or, and, the difficulty with that even is that, of course, making some sort of public statement against even a parishioner in good standing at one of your churches would come at great relational cost. I mean, that would be a real unpleasant, hopefully Christian, but nevertheless decisive confrontation at that point. And, it just can't help me. I can't help but, think, whenever the people talk about us, perhaps, I mean, the two or three that do, maybe, in negative terms, even fewer, the one that does, about being angry or bitter or something, my only response to them would be like, just like what has to be considered in a complex, kind of mixed, economy or ecosystem like Charleston is, or like any city that has Episcopal churches and an ACNA now. I mean, theology notwithstanding, all of the theology ultimately represented itself in the convictions and beliefs of actual people. And many of these people were at least formerly friends, former colleagues. I mean, I've got, family members for goodness sakes that, I mean, I'd like to stay in as close a fellowship as I can, but there are some decisive dividing lines and walls that have been built and crossed that have come at great cost. And so it's not like just an ideology that somehow, the quote unquote Episcopal Church is out there in some sort of entity that exists like the nothing and, never ending story. But it's like, of course, like it's a difficult reality to live in, I mean, and you can sort of offhand say golf foursomes have been split over this, but like sometimes those golf foursomes were fraternity brothers and have been friends and godparents and each other's lives for 35 years. And yet, now they worship across town and they may see each other at the, various birthday parties or funerals at this point. But there's a deep sadness and a deep sense of loss, like Demas, overcome by the lure of the world, and those who walked with us no longer walk together, walk together, no longer walk with us. And I just would push back on anyone who thinks that there's some sort of like hard set ideological or even, and I hesitate to say this, but I want to say theological, like it's not an abstract theological position. Like this is a life altering, gospel, grounded, position that has with great tear and great tears and sacrifice and persistent sadness, not anger, but sadness, nevertheless, we find ourselves in, right? And so to see something, to witness and to see the pictures and to the implications being it's just not that big a deal, brings into question and seems to denigrate all of the hard one sort of positions that have been scraped out and maintained for as Nick pointed out, decades really, but explicitly for 15 years. And it's just disappointing. I think that's what I keep coming back to. It's disappointing and demoralizing to see the response being, get over it. It's not such a big deal. Like, we really can in some capacity all get along. And, I, for one, have a list of family and friends and former ideas about my friend group in life that no longer exist, that I don't hold deep animosity towards, nor do I think about in that capacity that often, other than I wish and pray that we weren't in the situation we're in, and yet I'm grateful the Lord has carried me here and established me at this place. And and to your point, Matt, for the people looking on from the outside, the clearer we can be about that, and the more as gracious as possible, but straightforward and forthright, then the better for all the souls that have been put under our care and are similarly confronted by the same allures of the world. And that's where I'm. Well, that's kind of where I am at the moment. So I'll remain. I mean, I'll just see Matt. Maybe we'll get an explanation, or maybe it'll be sufficient. And I pray it will be. But at this point, certainly the questions still remain.
Well, we are at our time. Hopefully, we'll receive more information. Maybe we'll even have to record a follow-up to this week. We'll see. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going with us, please be in touch. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks, as always, to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.